Hello, and welcome to episode 2.14, the Hope Springs Eternal edition for March 22nd, 2023, of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. Well, that last gasp of winter sure was a doozy, but my calendar says it's now officially spring, and it does look like milder weather ahead for the foreseeable future. My wife came out of her physical therapy session late last week and told me she saw my good colleague and golfing buddy, Dr. Jack Croxton, getting some therapy for his sore shoulder. I told her he's probably getting himself in shape for the golf season. Hope springs eternal. As for me, I'm right behind him, getting the nagging soreness in my back and legs relieved so I can walk those 9 holes with Jack and take him on. Hope springs eternal. Baseball is just around the corner, and it looks like my Yankees will have a decent competitive team, while Jack's Pirates once again flounder over in Pittsburgh. Hope springs eternal. But no, Jack, Bill Mazeroski is not coming out of retirement to save the day. That hope, I believe, is gone. And if you're hoping that the 1891 Opera House has some good arts events in store for you, your hope is well-founded. In celebration of Women's History Month, the Art and Architecture Series is presenting the documentary Mary Cassatt, Painting the Modern Woman, on Saturday, March 25th at 1 p.m. Here to discuss her works with me is painter and professor Alberto Rey. Here with me now to talk about the upcoming documentary from the Art and Architecture Series at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House is Distinguished Professor of Art Emeritus, Mr. Alberto Rey. Alberto, welcome once again to the program.
It's a pleasure, Tom. It's always a pleasure talking to you about anything related to the arts. Well, I guess about anything, but...
but this is a good, good expertise level.
Yeah.
All right. So we have a program coming up about the Impressionist artist Mary Cassatt, who is a very, very interesting figure in the world of Impressionism. Of course, it's March. We're celebrating Women's History Month. And she, as a figure, has a lot of impact in terms of the time period, equal rights for women during the 19th century. She's a shining light.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she was very influential and influenced by her mother, who was very educated, and her family in general was pretty well off. And I think their expectations for her was very different than her own expectations for her life. They wanted her to kind of get married and stay in kind of high society. And her expectations was that she wanted to be an artist and try to find and try to influence people towards providing more rights for women. And I think that's something that she fought for her entire life.
Ah, yeah, she did, and we will probably discover that as we move along. Now, as you say, her family came from wealth. I think her parents were, her father, I think, was a very wealthy stockbroker. They lived in various areas of Pennsylvania as she was young, but she really got the art bug when she traveled to Europe. Because traveling to Europe was considered something that an educated person did in the 19th century. So she saw a lot of art there, and she was coming into a period of time where there was a lot of transition in the art scene, particularly in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think her family's lineage is from France or French, and her mother's family was in banking also, and her mother was a very well educated. And really helped her convince her father, who didn't want her to be an artist, to allow her to go to France. And start studying, and through tutors. I don't think she could get into the art school at the time, so she did study with other famous artists at the time. I think one was Gerome, realist painter, and she also did copies of paintings from the Louvre. And she stayed there for a short amount of time because she had to leave for the Franco German war. When she came back, she was under the thumb of her father again, who wouldn't even supply her with art supplies. I mean, what kind of support is that? And especially from
Not
a
much.
wealthy family.
Yeah,
Yeah,
not
so.
much. So, when we look at her work in time period, we're talking about someone who was familiar and generally speaking, knew all of a lot of the famous impressionists of the day. And I think one of the reasons she turned to the impressionists was because the salons had taken a few of their work, her works, but they were not really happy about it. And she seemed to say, okay, well, I've had enough of that. Let me go someplace where my work is going to be more accepted. And that seemed to be to the Impressionists.
Yeah, I mean, she wanted to live a life that was less restrictive and to do art that was less restrictive. And she realized that for her, she did get into a couple, actually several exhibitions at the Paris Salon, but it was clear that they wanted something specific and she wanted to do more experimentation and learn more. And she was drawn to Degas' work, and Degas was drawn to her work, and she and he invited her to exhibit with the other impressionists. She was the only American who was in that group, and her work really grew and became much more expressionistic. Her brushwork became more expressionistic, and it wasn't about the details necessarily as much as about the form. So it was about the paint itself and the application of paint more than trying to make something realistic or super realistic. And so it freed her. And I think that group was also kind of antisocial in a way that they didn't go to with the norms, and that allowed her to break away from her restrictions, social restrictions, and was able to work and spend more time with other artists who were more inclined to do the type of work that she was.
She seems to have been particularly taken with Degas and his work with pastels. And when you look at some of that work from her period, you can really see that influence, how she used pastel colors to be able to create her paintings.
Absolutely. I think Degas, her studio was only a couple doors away from Degas. And she was a model for some of Degas' work. And Degas got her into not only pastels, but also into prints. And they were both influenced by the Japanese artwork as well. And that became evident in their prints as well. So although Degas was very conservative in his feelings about women's rights, they got along otherwise as artists. It's interesting that late in her life, unbeknownst to Degas, they put their work together to support women's right to vote. I don't think he would have been too happy about that. But it's provided a lot of financial support for suffrage at the time.
Yeah, she really had as a he was one of her mentors, as well as Camille Pissarro, whom we talked about, I believe, sometime early last year when Pissarro's collection came through too. Now, when I look at her work itself, because I went and I just Googled her name, and all of these images came through. So many of them are portraits of women, of girls, of women in everyday life, women walking down the street, mothers and daughters. She just seemed to have a way of creating, and I'll give you my impression of it, and you can tell me, you can react to that. But there's just this impression of calmness and quietness and stillness in all of these works with women that are I find them to be incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, I think the work, I find it that there's two different periods, almost three different periods, with her work. Well, her most notable work. I think her work during Impressionism or Impressionistic influence was her work was much more vivacious with a lot of brush work and very powerful colors and the backgrounds were very rich, and some people feel that that might be one of her more powerful, or some of her more powerful work that occurred during that time. I think during after a few years of working with the Impressionists, she kind of felt that she wanted to move on, and I think you'll find that her work becomes a little more what you're calling calm, that the work becomes more peaceful in a lot of ways, and she starts to depict more mothers and children in her work, and she starts to do also a lot of portraits and commission work, and she continues to do that. One of the things I found interesting was I found of some of her pieces towards the end of her life, when she was starting to lose her eyesight, and the work became rich again. It became, maybe she was, frustrated a little bit by not being able to see everything that she could see before, or by the limitations of her life later on. But these colors, these super rich colors came back, and this brushwork came back to life again. And she started to, again, almost feel. It looked like she was giving up realism, maybe forcibly so, by her blindness or loss of sight, and started to incorporate more color and brushwork back into the work. So you lose the detail, but you don't, but you have the energy through the color and brushwork come back into her work again.
Yeah, she was very adamant towards the end of her life, I think, as she in her later in her career of stating that she was no longer attached to any particular school of painting, that she was no longer an impressionist or this or that or the other thing. She was merely a painter. And you can see in some of her later works that reality sort of come to life where there's kind of you see mixtures, I mean there's mixtures of things. You can see some great detail and some richness in some of the portraits, but with a more impressionistic background in a way, which I find rather interesting. There's one I'm looking at right now called A Child's Bath. I think it was 1893, and the specifics of the mother and child are very clear. But the background is very the pastels and the colors are detailed but muted, and it's an interesting mix.
I think the other thing that's interesting about her is not only how domineering her father was, but as she became more and more famous, mostly famous in Europe more than the United States. I mean, she got the Legion of Honor award for her contributions to art, and she sold quite a bit of work later on in her life. Her relatives, who were not supportive of her work, were, I think at one point they were supposed to inherit most of her work. And because they wouldn't support that suffrage exhibition I was telling you about, she decided to just sell the work. So a lot of the work that was supposed to go to them was sold. And the contributions from those paintings, selling those paintings, were provided for to support suffrage. And The thing that's interesting was that she never forgave them, not only her family members for not supporting the exhibition, but for not lending her work, the work that they had of hers for the exhibition. So it was kind of a bitter pill to take for her at the end of her life. And her brother also passed away at the end, right before she became ill. When they were on a trip to Egypt, he came ill and passed away. So it was kind of a tough end to a very kind of rich career. And again, she never married or had children herself, so she felt that she didn't. She wanted to contribute to kind of dedicate her life to her art.
Her work is not, explicit in terms of political statements on, the rights of women or anything like that. She looked at painting women, and of course, this exhibition at the Opera House is going to be about painting the modern woman. That's the subtitle of it. Her exhibitions and her paintings were more about trying to pull out that inner life of women, a deeper, more meaningful inner life, that I think she was remarkable at actually achieving. Now, even though she didn't make any, obvious statements in her artwork, she did, as you say, she contributed a lot of her efforts to getting her artwork into shows that would raise money for the suffragette movement and so on and so forth. So she participated when she could, but it's interesting that to me, anyway, that she chose that path for her artwork rather than others that she could have chosen.
She did do a mural that didn't survive, that was, I think, destroyed over time, that I think was called Modern Woman. And it was the mural was a three-part mural that included only women doing different roles in society. And because it didn't include any men, it created a lot of controversy. And although it did bring a lot of women who were interested in women's rights, did come to see the mural, but a lot of others did not appreciate it. It was a very different time that, I mean, the rights of women were just non-existent almost. Again, not only did you have no right to vote, but you couldn't even go to the bars or restaurants by yourself. You had to, come with accompanied by somebody else. And that's just, the tip of the iceberg as to other expectations that were considered by society norms at the time.
Well, as always, Alberto, thank you for your wisdom and insight. I really do appreciate it. I think that this particular documentary of Mary Cassatt's work is going to be really interesting to people, and I think they might have the same impression that I got when I began to look at her paintings and looking at how she painted, the modern women in her era and what she tried to draw out of that, the languidness, the peacefulness. I think will be quite enjoyable for people who go see the documentary.
Yes, and I think it's discussions with an expert on Mary Cassatt's work, who's written several books and reviewed several others. So it'll be interesting to see what she's found in her research over the decades.
All
Well,
right.
thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure.
Alberto's always very fun to talk to you as all, and we'll be catching you hopefully with another opportunity. Take care now.
All right, take care.
Mary Cassatt, Painting the Modern Woman, an Art and Architecture on-screen presentation, will be screened on Saturday, March 25th at 1 p.m. Tickets are $15 general admission, $10 for students, or if you purchased a flexible admission season ticket, those are good for this presentation. Purchase tickets either online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or call the box office at 716-679-1891. The Stage on Screen series is generously sponsored by Dr. James and Marcia Merens. For those of you interested in Alberto Rey's artwork, he has a new exhibition opening at the Castellani Art Museum of Niagara University on April 20th, 2023, entitled Biological Realism, Niagara River, Western New York. The exhibit features large-scale paintings and lush illustrative narratives to speak to the cultural and biological significance of the Niagara River. Check the show notes for links and more information. Giuseppe Verdi may have written only one successful comic opera, but it's a doozy. The next Live at the Met opera presentation is Falstaff, the operatic version of one of Shakespeare's most lovable characters. Professor Dan Ehas of the School of Music Voice Faculty joined me to talk about this delightful musical work. So I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast right now, Professor Emeritus of Voice from SUNY Fredonia, Mr. Dan Ehas, also spent a little time as the Interim Director of the School of Music. Dan, welcome to the podcast. Once again, glad to have you.
Oh, Tom, so great to be here. Thank you for asking me.
You bet. Now, coming up at the Opera House, of course, is this HD production Live at the Met of Verdi's Falstaff. And it is indeed the story, the Shakespearean story adapted of Sir John Falstaff, the fat knight who gets into all kinds of different trouble and stuff like that. But I want to make sure that the audiences understand, because there's actually two operas out there, The Merry Wives of Windsor and also this one's Falstaff. And this is Verdi's Falstaff. And can you kind of just articulate a little bit between the difference between the two?
Sure, I'll give it an attempt. So I think that this story of Falstaff, titled Falstaff, is really follows the plot line of Merry Wives of Windsor pretty well. It's a little bit reduced in a couple places, and there are interjections of Falstaff from other Shakespearean plays like Henry IV. Mm-hmm. So it's not the same as Merry Wives of Windsor, but the characters are the same. There are fewer of them, but they're basically the same, and it follows that same idea. You know, Falstaff is trying to seduce Alice Ford and make John Ford, what's his name?
Mistress Page. Ford and Page are the two.
Ford and Page, yeah. That he's trying to seduce them to get their to get money from their husbands, right? That kind of thing. So
right. Right, because as usual, he's broke and he owes money to everybody, and
he just wants to drink and have a good time,
and that's all he wants to do. That's all Falstaff ever wants to do. You got to admire the man for that. At least he's pretty honest.
Yeah,
I do know some of the kind of the differences in there, because in the first act, I believe Falstaff has an aria about honor, and that particular aria comes from Henry IV, Part One.
Right.
And it's a very famous one, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it's weird in this opera that Verdi wrote that there aren't any typical breakdown of arias and duets. It's not really structured in that same way. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple things that can be excerpted that are, you know, a solo bit or an aria and or a duet. There's a nice duet between Fenton and...
Nanette, I believe her name
Nanette,
is.
Nanette, yeah. And there's what we'll get to this in a minute, but we have kind of a local connection to Ford and Ford's aria that he sings. Is it a dream or is it reality? Mm-hmm. I'll just tell you now, one of our local former students, Michael Hawk, who is originally from Fredonia, was in the production of this last summer at the Aspen Festival with the reigning Falstaff of all time right now, Bryn Terfel.
Wow, very nice.
Yeah. Michael played the role of Ford and with Bryn Terfel as Falstaff. It was a wonderful production by all accounts. I'm going to share just a tiny bit of the, I picked out a review here, if I can find it. This is from Opera News. It said, baritone Michael J. Hawk sang Ford, a role that challenges the singer to set his voice again and again against that of Falstaff. Hawk seemed comfortable with the turmoil and rage of the part, as well as the more melodious material, and also held his own in all of the scenes with Bryn Terfel.
Wow.
Pretty amazing, huh?
That is amazing. I never had a chance to work with Michael. I think he just came at the tail end of my career, but he was he's a fantastic voice and
Yeah, super talent, great on stage, all of those things. Great package.
We wish him all the best. That's terrific. That is a great passage. So let's talk about a little bit about Giuseppe Verdi because this is one of his operas, and Giuseppe Verdi is one of like the big names in opera. You talk an Italian opera, you're talking Verdi for sure, right? Talk a little bit about Verdi and his work and his career.
Well, I think, when you talk about opera, one of the names that always comes up, Puccini, for example, or Verdi, because of the amount of work that they put out, and that was highly successful. Don't quote me on this, but I think Verdi wrote something like 28 operas or so. And I think this might be the only Falstaff might be the only comic opera he wrote. There was one other one, but it was unsuccessful. What I
Yes.
think is interesting and what is maybe different about this that people will want to recognize is that this was his last opera.
Yes.
And I'm
Yes, it
not
was.
certain that he even actually finished all of it. I mean, there probably were sketches of things, but I'm not sure that he finished everything, and it had to be finished by somebody else. The librettist is also a composer, so I think he may have had something to do with helping to bring it to its completion. But again, there must be like 28 operas, but they're all dramatic.
Yes.
I think of, like Rigoletto, for example, that I've done that a couple of times, and that's a very dramatic opera. And of course, when you think about the Shakespearean ones, he loved Shakespeare, but like Otello, and there are all these set pieces. There are the arias, there are the duets, the grand scena. That's the term we learn in music history about how he develops scene work musically for over a long period. Like there's a form to it. And this opera is completely different. Do you realize that there is no overture?
No, I didn't
There's no
know that.
overture. There is no overture. Yeah, I had to double check that myself because I thought, wait a minute, isn't there something? But there's only like, I don't know, like 10 or 12 measures or something right in the beginning, and then Dr. Caius shows up.
Wow. No, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and like when you think about Wagner, for example, he has all of these melodies or leitmotifs that are related to each character. So when you hear a certain theme, you realize that that's so and so. Whether they're actually on stage or not, that might be the voice of or the thought of that person, that character. Verdi doesn't really do that in this at all. In over a long term, there are a lot of these little ideas and they flash in and out, and it's like constant motion. The one thing that I didn't realize about this, but I guess they actually call it, musicologists call it through composed. In other words, it's not like the set formula of his other operas, which is kind of interesting. And in a way, it makes the action move along a lot faster. You have to really be on your toes. You're not listening to a character reflect on something that took place previously or how they feel emotionally about what's happening right now. I mean, they have some of that, but it's much shorter in duration, and the scenes seem to move quickly back and forth between other people. So it's much more exciting in that regard.
Well, this particular, I mean, this particular play, as well as the opera itself, would probably have to do that because the second act, the comic bit where he gets, thrown in the laundry basket and everybody throws their dirty underwear on top of him, and then he gets taken
It's
off
in the
and dumped in the
Thames.
Thames. That's got to
Well, the
move.
best in the best part is, I think in the be isn't it? It must be the beginning of Act Three then, because that happens at the end of Act Two, right?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
He doesn't he come back on stage and he's like soaking wet
He's
and trying to
soaking
shake
wet.
it off and has a nice what beer or wine or something to warm himself up.
Somebody comes in. Somebody comes in. A servant or somebody. I have no idea. But they offer him a glass of mulled wine to warm him up.
Mulled
And
wine, right? Right.
he has a wonderful little aria, a little moment about how great wine is. And that is also from,
Henry.
the Henry IV, Part Two. He has a great speech in that play about the wonderfulness, why wine is such a wonderful thing to have on the in this world and to drink and to partake. And it's an again, He's you know, it's really interesting because I know I said to you before we got on the actual recording for this that, you know, you're a baritone, so hopefully maybe one day you'll get a chance to sing Falstaff. And I'm a fat old guy now, and I think maybe I should play Falstaff in Henry IV, Part One. I get that opportunity, you know, because he's such a character that's so full of life,
Oh.
and I think Verdi brings that to life too. The other interesting thing about the play that I'll tell you, which reflects on the characters of the Verdi opera, obviously, is that it's the only play that Shakespeare ever wrote where all of the characters are middle class. There's no royalty in the play.
Oh.
They're all these little middle class people who live in Windsor and have ordinary lives and stuff like that. And Shakespeare brings in Falstaff, who is knighted, I guess, doesn't quite make
Yeah.
him royalty, but you know, he's that kind of top dog. But it's the only one of that where his characters are like that. So there's a way in which Falstaff and this Falstaff story, both in Verdi's opera and also in Shakespeare's plays, brings a certain sort of everyday life, you know, the funny things happening to just ordinary people.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to tell you, we didn't talk about this earlier, but I think it's amazing to me now, looking back. So this was premiered in like what, 1893 or something like that. I
Something like
forget
that.
what
Yeah. Verdi was
in
80 years
Italy.
old.
He was still alive when it was premiered, and he died within, what, 5 years or something after that. But it wasn't received very well. Initially it was, and he traveled around with it, and I think there's some story about the king of Italy at that point introducing Verdi to the opera public, having to stand up and get an applause at every performance that he was at or something. But it kind of fell out of favor. And I think it fell out of favor because people had certain expectations from all the other previous Verdi operas, listening to these great arias, these great expanded themes. The building up of a grand scena of some kind. And that's not what this was at all. And I think what I read was that people like Toscanini brought it back to the Met. I think the first time it was performed at the Met was after Verdi had already passed. And even at that time, it was not in the regular repertory. But now I think people have come to realize that it's really a masterpiece, that it's in a way more of a masterpiece, the way that it's put together with this sort of idea of being through composed short thematic elements that move the action along much quicker. You have to really be, as an audience member, be on your game to catch everything that's going on. You don't maybe even hear it the first time that you watched or listened to the opera. But the other thing I was going to say is, and I wonder how you feel about this, but I was looking at the Met's page because, I wanted to see who the singers were going to be. I don't know a single one of them, unfortunately. And so I wanted to see who's going to play Falstaff because, I mean, that's it. This whole thing is about Falstaff, right? So, and knowing that Bryn Terfel is like the reigning Falstaff, well, is he in it? No, he's not in it. He's not singing at all.
No, Michael Volle is
But
singing that.
yeah, he's German. There's one Ukrainian. The character who plays Fenton, I think, is Ukrainian. There's a couple of Americans, one from Chicago and one from St. Louis, the Nanette and the Alice Ford, I think. But what I thought was really interesting was just a little bit of clips that they showed on the web page is that it's an updated version. Yeah. So how do you feel about taking a piece like Shakespeare and updating it?
Well, you know, I here's my thought on that, and you know, our listening my audience is going to probably hopefully appreciate the Verdi being. It's set in the 1950s, actually.
Yeah.
This production of Falstaff, and I think that one of the interesting things about this particular play and this particular opera is the fact that because I believe it can take place, I don't think it's period specific. I think the characterizations of the people in it, the kinds of characters that they are, lend themselves to any era. And so there's nothing particularly specific that would say, oh, you have to have it as Elizabethan. There really isn't. You know, these kinds of people
Yeah.
have existed for eons, centuries. You know, I really do think that one of the things that it also does is it makes it relatable. The thing about this production I think audiences are going to like is the fact that not only is the story relatable, most people will be able to follow the story very easily, and the music is fun to listen to, but you attach that with a sense of 1950s in an era that they also can remember and relate. It's the past, but it's the not too distant past. Makes it all the more enjoyable, I think, for people who have all of that in mind. It's a really good opera to go to and listen if you think opera isn't your thing.
You know, when I first saw the picture of the video of it being updated, I thought, well, what are they trying to do? Is this just a cliche of some kind? But honestly, when you think about it, the themes are universal.
Yeah.
And I wasn't thinking about this earlier until you mentioned it, but the fact that it's all really about common people, these are the things that people experience. I mean, these are universal themes that we all experience. We can relate to all of this. It's
Yes.
not a farce in that sense, and it's not so heavily verismo that it's impossible to believe that it could be any one of us in the or we wouldn't know somebody like that.
Right.
And I think that just makes it so enjoyable. That would make people want to go and see it, you know.
Right. Well, listen, Dan, best of luck in your endeavors in the future. And I know we're going to get a chance to talk to you again as we continue to do the Live at the Met series. Thanks as always.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Falstaff by Giuseppe Verdi will be presented at the Opera House live in HD on Saturday, April 1st, beginning at 12:30 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $18 for members, and $10 for students. You can also use your flexible subscription for this event. Purchase tickets online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or call the box office at 716-679-1891. Live at the Met is underwritten with support from Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy W. Beaver. Here's the arts calendar for the upcoming 2 weeks from March 22nd to April 5th, 2023. At the Opera House, the cinema series continues with Maybe I Do, a three-couple rom-com starring Emma Roberts, Luke Bracey, Diane Keaton, Richard Gere, Susan Sarandon, and William H. Macy. It will be screened on Saturday, March 25th and Tuesday, March 28th, both nights at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $7 for adults, $6.50 for Opera House members, and $5 for students, available at the door only on the night of the screening. That One Crocodile and Tough Old Bird, two young musical groups with Fredonia roots, will be in concert at the Opera House on Friday, March 24th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $13 general admission and $5 for students. You can catch interviews with both these groups from previous podcasts. Ben Baker of That One Crocodile is featured on episode 2.1, while Nate and Matthew Corrigan of Tough Old Bird are featured on episode 2.13. Over at the university, things are back in swing after spring break. The Fredonia Dance Ensemble will be presenting their annual dance concert on Friday and Saturday, March 24th and 25th at 7:30 p.m., and the matinee on Saturday, March 25th at 2 p.m. Tickets are available online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets or by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501. The Fredonia Jazz Orchestra, featuring guest trumpeter Derek Gardner, will perform in the Rausch Recital Hall on Friday, March 24th, beginning at 8 p.m. Admission is free. Derek Gardner will also be performing at Domus Fair, along with Elliot Scassaro and the Nick Weiser Trio, the night before, on Thursday, March 23rd, with two sets, one at 5:30 p.m. and one at 8 p.m. This is a presentation of the Fredonia Jazz Society. Tickets are $25 at the door while they last. Other free events at the Rausch Recital Hall include Danielle Kuntz, harpist, on Monday, March 27th, the Brass Chamber Music and Brass Choir on Tuesday, March 28th, the Flute and Bassoon Ensembles on Thursday, March 30th, and the Woodwind Chamber Ensembles on Friday, March 31st, and Saturday, April 1st. And finally, the Fredonia Clarinet Ensemble on Wednesday, April 5th. All of these events are free and begin at 8 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall. It's also musical theater season at local high schools, and while I don't have a complete list of all area high schools performing musicals, I would encourage everyone to see if their high school is putting up a musical and to get out and support it, even if you don't have children, grandchildren, or other family members in it. And finally, the curated art exhibit Miscommunication, Language and Power in Contemporary Art continues at the Marion Art Gallery at SUNY Fredonia until April 16th. You can listen to an interview with Miss Amy Kong, the exhibit's curator, featured on episode 2.12 of the podcast. And remember, if you have an arts event coming up and would like to get it mentioned on the arts calendar, please send an email to operahouse@fredopera.org or call the box office at 716-679-1891 with your information.
Did he just speak to me like I was there? Like I was more than invisible air? More than the nerd who gets stuck in the chair at the front of the class? Did he make me believe I had pride? That being smart isn't something to hide? That I'd been sitting alone to the side, watching life pass me by, letting each moment fly, and always wondering why there's never a sign. But maybe here, it may be clear.
The Main Street Studios is readying its next theatrical presentation, a production of the musical Happily, the Musical. I caught up with a very, very tired and busy Jong Sang-woo, who is playing the featured role of Ben Summerwell, to get more insight into the production. It's a pleasure once again to welcome to the podcast Mr. Jong Sang-woo. He works with the Main Street Studios in Fredonia, and they're working on a new musical called Happily, and he is playing the part of Benjamin Summerwell. Jung, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah, wonderful. Wonderful to have you. This is a musical that's actually, as I discovered, has been around for quite some time, since 2017, and has received a number of performances here and there. And it's actually not your first time doing it. You've done this before. Seems to be your baby. So why don't you tell us about the musical and what attracts you to it?
Yeah, so the musical was in development for a couple years now. What the writer Livy Perrone thought was the final product in 2018, when we did it at SUNY Fredonia, my sophomore year of college, has evolved a little more and have then gone to Off-Broadway at the Actors Temple. And now we're producing it again here, each time a little different. It's good to be doing the show for the third time, the same role. Get to fix some mistakes that, you know, I regrettably made, you know, beforehand. I mean, from college to Off-Broadway, now here, it's a good opportunity to really take everything that I have done and have learned in between those time and reapply it and feel better about myself for it.
Well, and isn't that a little bit about what the musical's been about, really, in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, the musical is a adorable whole show. I like to describe it as a Disney-esque show. Uh-huh. The show is meant for children in a educational way to spread awareness and acceptance about women's rights as well as the LGBTQI plus rights. But because it's such a wholesome show, much like Disney, adults tend to enjoy it as well.
Uh-huh. And so you're hoping that this particular production of it will attract a young audience. It's aimed for a young audience, you think?
Hopefully that's the case, with Fredonia's main surrounding school and educational districts being a lot of the high school, middle school, and elementary schools, with outside of Dunkirk, Fredonia still being relatively close. We've been trying to contact the school administrators, the directors of theater at their schools to try to do a field trip or at least have an invited day for them to come to save a certain amount of seats.
Oh, good. All right. I think that's a good thing to do. Can you give us a little bit of the plot?
Yeah, of course.
We understand kind of what the broader concept is, but what actually happens in the musical? Where's the plot going?
So the short version of it is in this fairy tale world, much like Harry Potter, where there is a designated school called Happily Ever High, where mm-hmm. students are administered and are set into certain tracks of this fairy tale world. So like princes, king, princes, princesses, knights, fairy godmothers, advisors. So they're kind of given these roles as soon as they enter, and it is forbidden for them to change their tracks. With the current senior class about to be graduating the school, they are questioning if what they are doing and what their tracks are meant for them to do for the rest of their life. Much like, you know, real people jobs in the real world,
mm-hmm.
they're realizing that there are more things, the more important things than keeping tradition and following their dreams and being true to who they are and who they want to be. So the story is a big conflict between the students themselves thinking about if tradition versus their own happiness, what is more important. And in this fairy tale world, it goes about in a very wholesome and very simple way about educating, you know, girls can be knights too, two mm-hmm. princes can be together.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately about young adolescents growing into their adulthood, really figuring out who they are in this world and where they fit.
So what are, I'm curious now, what are some of the mistakes you think you made and how are... How are you seeing yourself improving in this show, as well as seeing the show itself improve over its various incarnations?
So the first production, there were quite a lot more roles. As it evolved, the character Ben that I have been portraying kind of got combined with a lot of the other smaller roles, making him this monstrous line-heavy role, which I'm very happy about, which I got to experiment off-Broadway, and I get to really dive deep into it. But as a performer, you know, as a singer, just being able to sing better,
mm-hmm.
Like I mentioned before, the show is very simple because it is for educational purposes for young ones.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the issue, or not an issue, let me rephrase, an obstacle when it comes to simplicity and beautiful music is that your vocal choices and where your voice is matters the most, because there's nowhere to hide.
Mm-hmm.
When you know, the simple accompaniment and etc. So going from my college sophomore year, which I was like 19 at the time, going to Off-Broadway, which was last summer when I was 23, it's been, you know, I got to reflect a lot as along with the new materials and really diving deep into trusting my instincts rather than overthinking everything as a college student would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by mm-hmm. the time it hit last year, I was in a very good place where I didn't have to overthink about every little choice that I made, or is my hand moving the right way for this specific physical choice, you know? I'm starting to learn that my instincts are more true than I think, and being able to not have my brain fill with those thoughts and just going into it and having fun and living in the moment, it definitely changed a lot of my perspective. And then this third time around, I get to really think about some of the choices that I've been making and really try to dive into what this show could do for younger audiences and making simpler choices for the younger audiences.
I think it's actually quite an interesting show, and when you look at it for younger audiences, because one of the things that the show does not do, at least as far as I can tell, is really it makes the characters easy for younger people to grasp. They're not really complex characters. They're not really nuanced characters. They're really sort of, you know, straightforward. You could easily see that I'm trying to avoid, I guess, using the word stereotype or cliche, but they're easy concepts for young children to grasp. Yes.
Yeah, there are very clear obstacles for every characters, and there's very clear solutions, making it easier for younger audiences and making it a little simpler for the younger audiences. But adults seem to love it too. The biggest feedback that we've received as a company, not just here but in the past few times I've done it, was the older generation saying, "I wish I had this when I was growing up." And you know, that's a great feedback to have, which means it works great for younger audiences. You know, it's like a proof.
I understand that this version also has it. Am I right in hearing that there's like six new songs being premiered in this version, that it's a little bit more music heavy than the past ones were?
There's underscores including new duets, new company songs, new solos. It's certainly very, very different from the first version that I did in college. You know, characters' relationships change. The Ben's main love interest, Will, in our version now, and the version I did off Broadway, they the character Juliet were our siblings. But in the very first version, when I did it my sophomore year, they were love interests. And just going with that, certain song changing and other characters becoming bigger and smaller, it definitely created a new dynamic that I think that works in favor of the show.
It should be interesting to listen to the six new songs that are coming up, and it's always nice to be able to premiere that kind of thing. In doing my research, I ran across a lot of different things that I was able to read and see and so on that are on YouTube and on the internet. And I caught an interview with the young woman who wrote the book for it, Livy Perrone, I believe her name is pronounced. And she was asked an interesting question, and I think I'm going to ask that same question of you. One of the She said that occasionally she's heard about this show. One of the objections that have been raised is that it's too optimistic a show, that it does have the possibility of giving to young people an overly optimistic concept of what it is that they can actually achieve in the world. How do you respond to that kind of criticism?
The first version, absolutely. I think it was just very happy, very light consequences. The version that we are doing here today in 2023 has definitely some bigger consequences for the characters. There are actual consequences for the character's action rather than like a nice slap on the wrist from what it was in the past in the earlier development. I think it is a good amount that these characters face. Because they're dealing with real heartbreaks in the show or real life consequences where they basically failed and there's no other choice. There is a scene, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a scene, a character named Celeste. Her whole thing is she's in the princess track but doesn't really care to be a princess and be a damsel in distress. Instead, she wants to be the hero of her own story, meaning she wants to be a knight. She is forbidden to go to the final assessment presentation, which is the last step you need to do before you go out into the world from the educational system of happily. And that basically means she failed and can't move on, which means she's going to be a peasant, which is another thing. If these characters were to fail at their assignment, at their given task, they will become a peasant, permanently cut off from their family and friends, basically living a life of poverty, which is a very high stake in their world. And it From the very first version to this now, there are real consequences talking about that. And I think Livy did a great job from when it was first written to really emphasize what's at stake for these characters that they're viewing.
It's a show too that I think when you look at it in the if we can even expand this conversation to the current cultural zeitgeist, this show is one where in a world where you're seeing a little bit more repression about of the themes that are in this show from society at large, particularly when you look at figures like Governor DeSantis, or situations in Tennessee where drag shows are public drag shows are being banned. How do you fit this show into that particular context that we're experiencing now in society?
Usually, my personal thing is I am within the community, and growing up, I've only ever seen movies that are like it's all gay in your face, they're kissing, they're gonna be together, and there was never a story growing up where it was just like a normal movie where the happen one of the characters just happens to be queer, and it's not the main plot of the story where it's just like being shoved in your face all the time. And I say that we're specifically shoving in your face because when there is a queer movie, they make sure the audience knows that it's about the queer characters, which is lovely and it's fine. But when you know, when you are growing up to where you get to make your own decisions and really think about yourself in this world, you kind of want to see a TV or a movie or a theatrical show where they're just a character, not glorifying that they're queer, because that's not all they are. It's just a part of them. So growing up, I started to hate those type of movies, which is when I found a show where it doesn't really treat it like a show that is basically about the gay epidemic of the world and their acceptance. And it just is the characters dealing with consequences and really struggling through their obstacles, and they just happen to be queer. With that being said, I think it is a lovely way of approaching these large subjects at a simpler form, where it's not in a, where some people that is banning trans reading to kids, which is so silly. There's much bigger problems in the world, but to back to the original narrative, it's a lovely way of educating kids without the kids even realizing, I don't think. I've performed in front of kids before, and, you know, usually when kids see two people kiss, they're like, ew, ah. It's, you know, it's just the kids, but no kids that ever seen the show has actually made that type of noise.
Right.
Being gross because two people are kissing.
Right.
They were intrigued by the story. They didn't think it was, like, anything bigger than what it was.
Right.
And I think that kind of speaks for itself.
Yeah, children always have a lot to teach us, I think. What are you going to choose to do for yourself in the future? I have a hard time imagining that, you know, you're going to be here for the next 50 years. But what are you thinking of in terms of yourself as a performer, an artist, and you know, seeing your career moving forward?
My career personally, I think, has been very fortunate. As soon as I graduated, I got to work at an equity theater in Florida. So far, I haven't needed to work a side job, nor have I gone more than 2 weeks without doing some sort of theater work. And I am very fortunate. I know that's, you know, it's because I worked hard, but I know also that it is heavily based on luck. Them just having to click my video or them just having to call my number, you know. It's not always about this or that, but I fully understand that I have been very lucky, which I don't take for granted. But yeah, it hasn't really stopped. Even when I decided to do Happily Here, I had some great, great, great offers, but I turned it down because I'm not a type of person that's, I don't know. I believe that when I do theater, it's not necessarily for the fame of it or the money. I really just do it because it's what I want to do. And that's how I've been kind of going with life, applying for whatever I think is going to be great. And, you know, if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, that's fine. There's plenty of other shows I can apply for. But definitely since last summer or beginning of last summer, my career has truly picked up on big names and as well as being recognized and such, which I'm very fortunate for. As soon as Happily's over, I'll be leaving to go to Connecticut, 4 days after it closes. Currently in callbacks for a national tour, which is great.
Oh,
fingers crossed. And a few other projects, but I don't know. I'm very fortunate that my brain got to be wired like this, but I just stopped becoming scared of, like, not having a job after, because it does seem to work out for me, for the better or the worse, knock on wood.
Well, that's good. I hardly think anymore one could approach the business of acting in theater without having that kind of mentality. Jung, thank you very much for being once again on the podcast. I really always appreciate your insights. You're always a delightful young man to talk to, and I wish you the best.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Yep, you too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Happily, the musical will perform on March 24th, 25th, 31st, and April 1st at 7:30 p.m., with matinees on Saturday, March 25th, and Saturday, April 1st at 2 p.m. Tickets are $15 for the general public, $10 for students, and $8 for 12 and under. Call 716-410-3597 for more information, or email them at info@playonarts.org. And before I wrap up, another reminder that registration is now open for the 1891 Run for the Opera House. This year's annual 5K Run Walk will take place on April 23rd, 2023, beginning at 9 a.m. You can get all the information you need as well as register online at www.fredopera.org/the-1891-run. Check the show notes for this podcast for links to the information and registration pages. And that's it for this Hope Springs Eternal edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Professor Alberto Ray, Professor Dan Ehas, and Mr. Jongsang Ru for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is available wherever you get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, April 5th, 2023. I'm Tom Lachlan, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.